Hi, welcome to On Writing, your fortnightly podcast about online writing communities and the terrible advice they give. My name is Sean, he, him.
I am Chad, he, him, and meow is fine and in the other room.
Aww, nice. Meow. I'm MJ, she, her.
And MJ, you have the writing madness now, right?
I do. Dear listeners, I just finished writing over 24,000 words about Anne Rice.
In just the month of March.
I reread The Witching Hour and I watched the show, and we're covering it at my work because the show has come out and now people are like, what happened in the book? I don't actually want to read this motherfucker. It's over 1,000 pages. And so I made it far less pages.
And that's almost as many words as Anne Rice wrote about Anne Rice.
Oh, she wrote so many more.
She would not shut up. Anne Rice's things that she would not quit. She would not cut anything, including the anti-Semitism.
I did not remember that at all. Like, I was expecting the like anti-black people, like Southern brain rot problem. Like, I knew that was there, but like, I did not remember that. Like, they're just like two offhanded comments, but they're pretty significant in terms of like what the book and the show is about.
Well, it's also like the first like section of the book where they're like evil Jewish doctors aborting good Christian babies. And you're like, what the fuck? Excuse me.
It's also funny because she describes the anti-black Southern brain rot. And I'm just like picturing this kind of weird frog from my town going, hey, we don't hate black people. We gave them their own graveyard and everything.
Oh, my God. That's so Anne Rice.
That's literally like part of the vibe in Anne Rice shit. Where she's like mad that like a ghetto didn't retain its specific ghetto character, that it was like
it's changed. Got too many black people now. The Irish Channel has too many black people now.
Yeah, the ghetto they built for Irish people now has black people in it. And she's like, this is wrong.
And this was in like 1989 too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much blacker now, Anne Rice.
1990 is a little bit, again, once Fresh Prince is on air, you have no excuse, okay?
Nope.
I look, it's like big energy of she's all like, well, it's just easier to like cosplay that the Irish are white. Okay. it's like, okay, you know how you know that doesn't really taste like banana, but you want it to look yellow anyway?
Yeah. But this led us into the on ramp for what we want to talk about, because the other thing that happened 2 weeks ago, in addition to, you know, St. Patrick's Day and stuff, is that a show came out, a show of one of my favorite books. Yay! Three Body Problem on Netflix is out. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, Christ. Oh, shit. And so it's finally time. Anne Rice, Three Body Problem, Chad's secret sauce that you will not know is coming, because we pretty much guarantee you have not seen this movie unless you were at literally My Hollywood Video in like 1998 or whatever the crap, right?
Well, what's also great is that this is going to sound eerily specific, but it's all going to tie in at the end that I don't think Danny Glover has seen this movie.
Yes.
Okay.
It's bad. And this all leads us to, what is an adaptation? Because there are good adaptations, there are bad adaptations. There have been countless thousands of words written about the nature of adaptation. And there's basically a few points of consensus. One, that there's this thought that adaptation is a modern phenomenon that consists of when you take a book and then you make a movie or TV show of it. And it's like extremely loud, incorrect buzzer. The Renaissance people and medieval Europeans and ancient Chinese people and Middle Eastern peoples of all fucking creeds, Zoroastrian through Islam, have all been like, you know what? That's a good painting. I think I would like to write a song of that painting, and then I would like to make a play of that song, and then I would like to make a table of that play. And you're like, what?
And then a dance about this whole process.
Exactly.
Well, and then one person goes, and then I'd like to make an icon out of that table.
Mm-hmm.
And then a very angry Greek man comes and burns it and says,
yes, exactly. That's the end of the loop, is that the Greek man comes and is like, we do not need this anymore. And then I will do some police corruption now. Yeah, those are the two things that happen.
That's why my stance is now that we should start calling people on social media that bitch about every remake and reboot, or just bitch about all that stuff. We call them iconoclasts.
Yes. Well, that's kind of the thing here, is that. Like, the process of adaptation was a lot freer before copyright. right? Mm-hmm. Because people would literally be like, I'm making a play of the Bible story of the that I saw in a tapestry, right? I have no idea what the actual Bible story is. I don't speak Latin. I don't need to know that shit. I just saw a really cool tapestry. I'm making a play about it. And you're like, I really don't think Samson did all that, but okay, right? And that's kind of the nature of adaptation, is that in a pre-copyright environment, adaptation consists a lot less of transcription, because there's basically no assumption that the previous work has been observed. Now, this is contrasted with the Chinese tradition of adaptation, where it's assumed that the previous work has been observed. And there's a really beautiful word. I believe it's pamplicestuous, where the metatext of the work, the old work, the one that it's adapted from, is ontologically present above the current work. So when you're watching Lord of the Rings, the text of Lord of the Rings is haunting it. When you're holy watching shit. Three Body Problem.
You just defined my magnum opus, which is the most erotic, pamplicestuous, ontological fan fiction of all time.
Hell yeah. Which one would it be? Also copyright.
I don't know. We're still in the larval stages. Okay. All I know is like, I'm the amoeba floating through the primordial soup that just got a glimpse that there's trees somewhere and went, I must go there.
I gotta go. Yeah, pamplicestuous is like the best word. And I honestly don't think the field of adaptation theory would be as robust as it is if that dude hadn't come up with the word pamplicestuous. And you're like, okay, yeah, I think this is some real study now. I think there's some theory we could put behind.
Well, the best part is I am pretty sure that whoever came up with that word winged it in the middle of a lecture when he saw everybody dozing off. And so just dropped pamplicestuous when, that got your attention.
Yeah, well, poets can't resist the word pamplicestuous, right? Like, they literally can't. It's a
specific thing that it's like if you put a piece of translucent paper on top of something else and you can see the image underneath it, or if you erase something, but you can still see the, like, impressions if you, like, run, like, ink or pencils over the grooves of the written thing. Like, that's what it's literally describing in the, like, poet version of it.
Yes, and that's literally it, right? But the idea, it's pamplicestuous because the two fields are interacting with each other.
It's making the noun into an adjective is what happened there. You added, like, an O-U-S or whatever on the end, and
yes,
it's become an adjective and more academic.
And more Anne Rice-y, because it's, like, incestuous.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a very important topical pop culture question about this. What's more pamplicestuous in this relationship? Star Wars and Tatooine to Dune and Arrakis? Or what those guys are doing to their Dune popcorn buckets?
I think probably...
Are they doing it while they're doing the other thing is the question. Like...
Well, to the Dune bucket, it's Xenocest, right? Like, they're... It's an alien, right? So I guess if they were literally Leto Atreides 2, right? The one who shows up in the later movies that will get made that is also a worm, it would be if it was him. But
I was talking about what the guys in the audience are doing with their popcorn buckets.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
Okay,
I'm
saying just Leto Atreides, we're all on the same page here.
If Leto Atreides was there with his popcorn bucket, it would be pamphlet.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And by the way, I've never read or seen Dune, just FYI.
No, it's okay. You live in post 1977 America. Like, you have just immersed Dune. Like, you've photosynthesized Dune.
Osmosed it.
Watching my father watch Dune, going, oh my God. Oh my God. I've just loved Dune this whole time.
It was just Dune. It was Dune all along.
Well, this is literally me with Anne Rice. Like, when I've gone back and reread her for the first time in fucking ages, like, I am like, this is why I am the way that I am. Holy fucking shit.
Well, so there. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, there's two people I can ask about this. There's literally the stupidest person on the planet who claims to be an authority on vampires. And then there's two people that are actually smart. So I'll turn to you two. Was she the one that came up with the idea as vampirism is more than an STD, that there's like a consensual act of transference that has to happen that also still blurs consent lines? Or is there literature beforehand where, and obviously I'm talking about the bite, give blood, which completely changes the act of vampirism from a viral thing into like a quasi-consensual thing.
Well, Anne Rice, let me warn you, if you're going to ever especially dip into her erotica, which is like it goes Interview with the Vampire and then a bunch of erotica and then Vampire Lestat and a little more erotica and then like The Witching Hour. But if you go back and look at her stuff, she's not about consent. She is really into the non-con of varying like consensual like rape and non-consensual rape. That's her deal.
Yeah, oh, content absolutely. Warning, we might say the R word a lot in this one.
Sorry, yeah. We are talking about Anne Rice, so we...
Yeah.
No, so, like, absolutely, and that's part of what makes this... That's part of what's interesting is that I don't want to praise her intelligista too hard, but she's so into overstepping consent or going around consent. All the things are in consent that she had to form an Ur thesis of consent in order to violate in the first place.
Yeah, right? Kind of.
It's like, I can't enjoy this unless, like, so, and that's kind of why I described it that way. That it's not true consent when you kill somebody and then go, by the way, sucking down my blood here is the only way that you're going to survive this. Like, that's, even in the film Interview with the Vampire, that's like the entire thing is that, like, Lestat is a rape victim that is, like, doing what he considers to be like less forms of rape on people, but that yeah. makes him better than the person that raped him. Right. It's a transference of abuse and trauma.
I think a big thing here is that Anne Rice like got Vampire. She like was fucking synced up her signs so fucking tight with like a vampire concept that all vampire concept is now just Anne Rice's.
Concept. Well, fun fact, she wrote Interview in the Bay Area and didn't move back to New Orleans until the Mayfair Witches.
She wanted
to be in New Orleans moving, when she was in the Bay Area,
which is about a girl moving from the Bay Area to New Orleans. That's what is in fact.
Well, so that's why I'm curious if there was vampire literature beforehand that had the concept of consensual transformation, even though yes, like the way they do it violates the concept of consent that they're establishing. But before that, Blade, a far superior piece of vampire literature, with the great quote, "Motherfucker, you must be at your goddamn mind." That aptly has the part where, like, the doctor goes, "You're just a fucking STD, right? You just bite somebody and they become a vampire. You're not a culture." I'm curious if there was literature that beforehand, or if she invented the entire idea that the victim isn't automatically a vampire just because they're bit, basically.
Oh, no, it goes back and forth. Like, over the hundreds of years of vampire lore that, like, predates Anne Rice, not just counting, like, Dracula and Carmilla and all of that stuff, but if some of them are, like, you gotta transfer the blood, like, there has to be an exchange of blood. It's sometimes it is, like, what you're talking about, like, you bite and it's, like, werewolfed out, like, you're just gonna become the thing.
Sometimes it's the my favorite one from folklore, not fiction per se, even though the line between folklore and fiction is very foggy when we're talking about adaptation, is when a vampire kills you, your corpse is a vampire that is a different entity than you were, right? that needs mm-hmm. to be dealt with in different ways.
Yeah, then you've got like the Romanians and the Balkans people that are like, I don't know if there's consent involved. I don't let the cadaver get that far.
Look, we're just decapitating corpses on general principle here, right? Like, it's okay, not
literally,
just
there is a scene of a corpse reanimated by Lasher having sex with a living person. So Anne Rice is all over this.
Anne Rice, content warning mark. I think that's three now.
Well, and then the next content warning mark when like I was young and I watched Interview with the Vampire, and I'm like, so I'm pretty confidently straight, but this film is raising questions that wouldn't have normally been raised in my normal life. just generally with Armand walking around being Armand, right? Just he walks in, he's all like, "Hello." I'm like, "Okay, fine, I'm gay. Fine, fine, like, whatever."
That's legit, man.
Yeah, batter down the ram. Use the battering ram on the wall, okay? And he's all like, "He said hello." Oh, he's got the rack out. He's got the rack out. What an asshole! And I'm like, but he's only in this movie for like 5 minutes. I can't wait to dive into 13-year-old Byzantine cherub. What the fuck?
Yeah, not the same. MJ, you want to talk about that? Because you found some cool shit about that, right?
Oh, I have been reading a little bit about, because there's a book of interviews with Anne Rice, and some of them are about, like, she was, like, shocked at Armand's depiction in the movie, because she was really involved in the movie, but actually, the fun fact about Antonio Banderas is he was cast in the Exit to Eden movie, which came out the same year as Interview with the Vampire, which is like impossible to find, but it's an adaptation of one of her like very, very erotic BDSM novels. He was cast as the lead guy in that, but he couldn't do it because he was off playing Armand. So we could have had him in that, in Exit to Eden, and that it's, oh man,
the like finite sexiness of Antonio Banderas. It's like, it is a renewable resource, but you can only extract so much of it at a time, right? It's like an old growth forest. You gotta let it build back up after a while. There's not infinity.
I'm kind of laughing at the notion that, like, okay, so there's the big question that's going around in like kind of crazy weird pop psychology on Twitter, asking like why queerness has gone up so much recently, and there's like the academic answer of like, well, it turns out people have always been this level of queer. It's that society is now gradually opening up to allow them to express what's always been there. Whereas I'm saying that you're awfully bold to survive to expect that kids' heterosexuality of the 90s was going to survive the double whammy of Interview with the Vampire and The Mummy.
Yeah, that was not happening. It's just, they were never designed for those tolerances, right?
No, yeah. Not at all. But I think this is such an interesting case, the like Interview with the Vampire being so profound and so quotable and like directly from the books. Like Anne Rice was all about it. But then Queen of the Damned, not at all. And these are like two different like ways you can adapt like a book. Anne Rice would have been there for it, the Queen of the Damned, but they didn't let her.
Well, I think that segues kind of into what I was want to talk about in this notion of adaptation, because adaptation theory also extends past, you'd mentioned that there's two different, those are two different models, right, where you follow it or you don't follow it, but the ways are much more broad than that, right? Mm-hmm. There's also like like an antithesis to it, and this is the parodic antithesis, right? You could say things like epic movie are or scary movie are an adaptation of things like The Grudge and Scream, right? Because mm-hmm. they are literally taking the same story, taking the same elements, and putting them together different. And you're like, but that's a parody. That's not an adaptation. It's like, well, but if adaptation is taking the parts and reassembling them in a different way, it sounds like it fucking is, right?
It's also really funny because it's a point where, like, it's not quite pamphlet sexual, but it could be possibly, like, show bill sestuous. Right, like maybe Cliff Notes sestuous. Like, we got to find a smaller thing than a pamphlet, but it's there and it works.
Uh-huh.
I also like that I just blew it straight into pamphlet sexual.
Yes, that's a very particular kind of like a DSA organizing thing or marketing, where you're like, you have to put out more pamphlets, go flyer more. It's like, no, I don't think people are going to like abandon the great scourge of capitalism because you handed them like a glossy like three.
We actually do have to bring it back to Dune for a second, because the difference between like pamphlets estuous and pamphlet sexual is whether or not it was the current version of Dune, David Finch's version of Dune, or Alejandro Jodorowsky's version of Dune. Mm-hmm.
The entirely fictional one that would never have existed, right?
Where he stands there and goes, I read a lot about pamphlet sexual, and I thought, why can't we bring it to the next level?
Well, because it's physically impossible in three dimensions, Jodorowsky. We can't. It's not a filmable thing.
Well, and the best part is, as you're explaining that, he goes, come here, kitty. He's just not listening anymore.
He doesn't. Yeah. Motherfucker did not pay attention to anyone talking to him.
For those that haven't seen, by the way, the mesmerizing look into madness that was him thinking he was ever going to make a Dune movie. Which mm-hmm. was him just flying around with money, grabbing people he found in credits of movies. They're like, you have mm-hmm. the rights to this, right? It's a small thing. We get to that. But like, the most magnificent part is that when it turned out that like rights are important, David Finch went and made it, and he was depressed. He was like suicidally depressed. And his son mm-hmm. was all like, Dad, let's just go watch it, and then like you can pick at it. And he's sitting in the theater, and they hadn't invented erotic popcorn buckets yet, so he's just wiping his tears away with his hands because he's got nothing else to do.
And I believe it's called the Shy Halussi, but okay, continue.
and he's watching. And then he's watching. And then according to him, he's smiling, and he looks at his son, and his son goes, what? He goes, it's terrible!
God, David Lynch is fucking awesome.
Oh, I'm sorry, David Lynch, not Finch.
Because it's important because he also cast like Kyle MacLachlan in it, and he would then cast him in all the Twin Peaks and stuff. Because like, yes, Paul Atreides, the perfect detective to like do like scat jazz next to like a log. And
it is also just kind of great because that we'll get to it more later. But one of the problems is that like there were no points where he looked at the book and went, "This is never going to look good on the screen." He's just all like, "Dude, just rub some like cubal shaped oil on the lens and that'll be their force fields and we'll just film this for 9 minutes."
I did show you that, MJ, right? The Lego brick.
Yeah. I think you might have showed. I think I like blocked it out. I think I've like repressed it. Card is
fucking dueling as a cube and you're like, "What in the fuck? What in the shit, dude? No, stop this."
Yeah, so, Captain Picard is all like, "The only way we can duel safely is if we do so at a resolution about on par with PlayStation 1 graphics. That way none of our vital organs will be rendered."
Literally like doing Roblox dances and then like, it's a bit too early for you, but your kids are going to love it, right? Like,
idea that he gets stabbed and goes oof and somewhere out there goes, "That's mine, I helped on this movie."
Yeah, exactly. Going back to the pamphlet thing though, and pamphlet's incestuousness, the incestuousness is important in here, the Anne Rice incestuousness, because it's unavoidable. You can never get away from the previous text. The only way you can is if people just don't know there was a previous text. So for instance, there was an adaptation called The Killer that was the adaptation of a French comic book, and people thought it was the adaptation of an American comic book, and so people went into it and was like, "Oh, this isn't what I wanted, but okay, it's kind of cool." But they, because they thought it was pamphlet-incestuous relationship with the wrong thing, they kind of negated that relationship, right?
There's a reverse one of what you're describing, where people go in to watch Manhunter, and they decide that it sucks because Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter isn't enough, like, Anthony Hopkins?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, so first of all, he did it first. Second of all, any bad acting in this movie is because of the CSI guy, right? Yes. Like, we're watching Brian Cox trying to act circles around this guy, and he's all like, "Will, do you still stay awake at night and think about..." And then it just pans from him, he's like, "I don't know.
I don't..." Mine? Line. Yeah, no, absolutely. And this hauntology, the fact that you can never get away from the original kind of defies the purpose of adaptation, like adaptation is transcription. But pulling it back a little bit, we can see that we haven't gone to a lot of movies lately because movies have this thing where they are too loud in theaters because theaters are mostly empty and their audio balance is based on a very full room. And B, they're all like 3 hours long. Like every movie that comes out now is fucking super duper long.
And they can't give us a goddamn intermission. Like, just give me an intermission. I'll buy more snacks. Like, come on now.
Exactly. I'll buy a program. I'll buy one of those stupid popcorn buckets. that's all you need. And like, so there's
just a process. Just give me a modesty curtain and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Look, this won't be my first rodeo in a darkened theater, buddy.
But yeah, that's exactly it. Where we're like, okay, the experience of watching a movie in your home where you have a natural privacy booth is different than one in a theater, right?
But no popcorn buckets. Okay, I'll back off the popcorn bucket. This has caused generational scarring on me.
It's fine.
Look, man, you can have those buckets at home if you want. You can bring them home, you know.
Exactly. Well, you can't anymore. I think they're super duper sold out.
Okay, well, yeah, but you could
have. I'm so glad Zoomers weren't there when the Pokemon movie came out and like we were getting those promotional shit from like Burger King. Cause I guess I'm also kind of glad that at the same time, when you consider like her jade and gold stuff, I'm glad that like, what's her name? Gwyneth Paltrow wasn't like that big at the time. She was still just like controversially Harvey Weinstein's shoe in for fucking best picture. But like, god, could you imagine if the Goop lady got her hands on the gold Pokemon cards from that movie? God. Tie-in
the unusable Mew card. I love that shit. But yeah, so we can say that the same medium, right, the same fucking product, like film reel that's projected onto a screen, is different, is somehow adapted if it's running through your VCR versus a projector. if it's running through a pausable medium versus not. If it's running through one with scene selection and subtitles there.
Yeah, this is funny because this is kind of a level of, I don't even want to call it, it is kind of pedantic, but it's useful at like an academic level or a higher level of trying to understand artistic expression that like, yes, the thing that you're experiencing, the art that you're experiencing, the manner in which you're experiencing it will dictate the outcome.
Yes.
This is part of like, and understanding the balance in conversation and what people are looking for is really important, because it's kind of like Andy Warhol understood that too much and couldn't understand the content itself also has value, right?
well, he understood it had value. He just understood the wrong heuristic of value, right?
there is a fundamental truth to the fact that like if you were cognizant in 1993, the experience of watching Jurassic Park in theaters was fundamentally different than watching it with the three or four commercials that came on the VHS that you had to fast forward through, mm-hmm. and the tracking lines when you watched it on your small CRT TV, or if you were lucky, the really big widescreen TV that you had to sit at a different angle and shut the blinds in order to see, or else it was all dark and shadowy. But like, this is fundamentally different. I know this sounds weird, but Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 Secret of the Ooze is literally a different experience for me, because I remember the three commercials that played before it, and that's like a quintessential part of the experience for me, including one of them being the Brady Bunch from hell.
Well, that's part of it, right? Is that when we talk about shit like the medium, the meshes, the Bartesian or Derridian hypothesis, right? We can see that like there's even in the same medium there's more, right? So if I Holy watch a DVD shit. Of like Treasure Planet, it's different than watching a VHS of Treasure Planet.
I literally have to bring up that I just Googled "We're the Brady Bunch from Hell," and the top hit on Google is a Reddit post from 10 years ago on r/TMNT called VHS opening Ninja Turtles 2 Secret of the Ooze. This is crazy nostalgic for me, and I was hoping it would do the same for some others on here. And it's a thread of people going like, yes. And then one person walking around going, I was frozen today. Because yes, Suburban Commando was one of the fucking advertisements on TMNT2.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you just described is interesting, because that proves that there's something to this shit outside of theory. Because what you've just proven is intersubjectivity, right? That you're not the only person, that most people who have watched this fucking VHS version came away with that same impression, right? That this is part of the text of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We're the Brady Bunch from hell, even though that's not present in like the theatrical fucking cut.
Yeah, right? It's not a part of like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle canon. Like Go Ninja Go is not intrinsically tied to Suburban Commando, but
yeah. But do you remember that where Vanilla Ice went on stage after the ninjas broke on, and then he starts fucking giving the ninja rap? This was actual Vanilla Ice. This is not a joke.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is pamphlicestuous.
Yes.
This is real ass Vanilla Ice going, hey, cool, something else licensed I'm not going to pay for.
Go ninja, go ninja, go.
But then it also ends with Splinter disciplining all of them for being seen, and then going, and remember, go ninja, go.
Well, I wanted to mention the hauntology and the palm.
Okay, you have my attention.
Of the the adaptation of the Mayfair Witches is set in a post Katrina New Orleans, which is, as you know, Chad, extremely, extremely different than like the pre Katrina New Orleans that Anne Rice describes in the novel.
I know it wasn't occupied by one Final Fantasy 14 player, I'll tell you that fucking much.
So like when I saw the opening and even just like the buildings and the look of the Mayfair Witches, it looked like Treme, because Treme was about like how it starts to look different in New Orleans after it's fucking rocked by a hurricane. And that's not what the book does. And like, they could have set the book in the like 1989. There's no reason not to, but they decided to put it completely modern and make a bunch of horrible changes in terms of like making the racist character the black guy, which is, they've done this before in Anne Rice adaptations.
Yeah, immorally racist. Most racist character, you make them black. Now it's not racist. And you're like, oh, wait.
I'm going to unironically give you a glimpse into why that comes out of Louisiana. And it's not from the direction that you think it is. It is not from the, what was her name that thought it was weird that, like, all of her cookbooks said that, like, you should just, you should let your Mandingo not fight tonight, but instead set out the fine china for you.
Oh, who? Oof. Was it Paula Deen who was like the one who did the plantation theme wedding?
It might have been. Yeah. That sounds
yeah,
so right.
It's not a Paula Deen perspective, right? It's not like, I can't believe they can vote now, right? So Louisiana is weird. Okay. Yeah. It's really fucking weird.
Statement of the century.
and Rice agrees.
Yeah. When I was in high school, just as an example, when I was in high school in Louisiana, there was a white and black prom king and queen.
Oh,
now we had a Michelle Pfeiffer carpetbagger come down trying to reach these kids and show them how to live like New Englanders. And that was obviously one of the first things that she went after. Right. She's like, we can't have that. That's terrible. That's segregation. The white people were all for getting rid of that. And the black people were pissed and said, no, we need to keep the segregated things. Now, the perspective isn't. Again, it's more complicated than it appears on the surface. It's generally speaking, because shit just isn't resolved in Louisiana. They threw up some train tracks, moved on different sides of it, and they glare at each other from either side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened is that now both groups kind of are now growing tall instead of growing wide, but they're growing on a foundation of racism that overlapped with each other. So you'll have generations, you'll have like an entire generation of people that like have no experience with this type of thing. But they're encountering somebody whose parents had experience with this type of thing. And that person will have kind of a grudge against somebody else, or they'll feel threatened by somebody else. And they'll be like, no, we don't see it as you segregating the prom royalty. To us, it feels like you're giving us the opportunity to have prom royalty that normally wouldn't happen in a southern state. And so these weird self-segregated lines create situations where somebody who is not as liberal or progressive as like you would think if you are literally anybody in California, but for Louisiana is like very liberal and progressive, and they do something like really stupid, like thinking that much like Paul McCartney, they're going to end racism with ebony and ivory and just go to the other side of the railroad tracks and be like, I come with good intentions, and then like get the shit beat out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And now they form a whole new grudge. And what it deep down comes down to is the very ugliness of the cycle of hatred, where it's a self-perpetuating machine that like neither side can get off of. And I know that Anne Rice especially moved to the Bay. Okay, if a Louisianan can stomach the Bay Area, okay, they have liberal progressive views that are unusual in Louisiana. It doesn't matter what they say about anything else, because, okay, when my barber gave me a haircut, he was getting a little fucking close to my fucking neck when I told him I was from California.
Mm.
And he goes, yeah, liberalism is a disease. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm not coming here ever again.
Jesus. Right, so, literally, so I'm in danger.
Hey, you don't happen to like Tim Burton musicals, do you? So the point being that you are going to find a lot of things to disagree with Anne Rice, but like progressivism is very relative to your surroundings. And I know that what happened is also progressivism. By the way, spoiler, it doesn't make you a good person. You're fully capable of being an asshole that also thinks that society shouldn't treat people a certain way. Mm-hmm. Case in point, Anne Rice had a lot of things where she was really fucking weird and kind of an asshole. But I also think that she entertained a lot of like surprisingly progressive Louisiana ideas. And then because she's kind of a bitch and kind of a narcissist, a black person being mean to her or running into black people who aggressively don't like white people, which is very common across Louisiana, she internalized that as like an informed attack against all of her progressive politics and went, oh, it's the coloreds that are racist.
Oh god, she even says not the word that you just said with the C instead of people of color. She does say that in the book like repeatedly.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. The funniest one with Louisiana progressives is that they're not caught up yet.
That they don't have the technology.
No, they're way past you motherfuckers and John Deere tractors. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Are you, you guys aren't even playing the same game. Oh, and they're fucking, their fish Doppler radar? Holy fucking shit. these dudes are just playing a creative assembly game on their computers when they're fishing. You get a lot of like really progressive, if they were in New England, they would be voting for Bernie Sanders types. But they didn't grow up in New England. They grew up here. And they get a little confused because they're not keeping up with what like the North does and all of these things. So they see people of color is a term that's being used. So they're like, oh, so we're supposed to call them colored again. Like not understanding the difference. They're just the... It's a freight car that doesn't understand there's other things on the caboose.
Yeah. I would also point out that a lot of leftism in Louisiana is based on literally Huey Long.
That's the other funny one, yes.
Where you're like, what should leftists do? I don't know, basically be mobsters. That's fine.
But that's another funny one, too, is that like there's a lot of people that are like, yeah, but Huey Long was a mobster. Yeah, but he was a mobster. That like wasn't a carpetbagger, so he was our mobster. He was a mobster for us.
Exactly. And it's like and it was okay that he gave all his cousins like jobs.
Well, I would say Anne Rice is go ahead.
Real fast, in the Capitol building, there's an exhibit you can go up to. Even if like you can just walk in and be like, I'd like to go look at the shrine, please. They're like, sure, come on in. You go up, and I think it's on the second floor. You go up, there's a shrine of the bullet holes where he was assassinated.
Jesus.
Okay.
And they're like, wow. And this is the day we lost Huey Long. What?
Okay.
He's also buried in front of the Capitol building, in front of a giant tower that has his statue on it.
That's rad.
Of course.
I don't like big, stupid statues unless they're like an abstract concept, like horse. Or if they're like your actual corpse is there. I think that you get to have a statue there if your actual dead body is inside.
And where I was going to agree with MJ on Treme was I watched that show like an asshole. I'll admit at the time I thought that I was too good for it. But like as I look at how my brain was going through it, I was just traumatized by Katrina. I didn't want to watch more Katrina.
You were reacting to Treme like Treme was reacting to Treme.
So for the longest time, I was treating Treme as a spinoff of what the Bunk was doing when he wasn't on camera.
Mm-hmm. Oh god. Oh man. But I think you're right about Anne Rice being very progressive in a huge number of ways. And I think that she pissed off people in Berkeley with her Sleeping Beauty series, which is hardcore, fantastical, like not based in reality, totally fantasy world BDSM, like really crazy BDSM shit. And I'm like, I do need to go back and reread it because it has been a minute. But like she uses some of that really, really like female centered gaze. Like she didn't call it that. She didn't know to call it that. And she would also often call like highly sexualized, high libido women as masculine or male. But she was the one who like introduced me to the idea of like, no, you can like sex as a girl and you can pursue sex as a girl and you can pursue like crazy kinky sex as a girl. And that's like all good. But
Well, I think in terms of like mainstream literature, she was like one of the pioneers of the idea of saying it's okay to say boys are delicious.
I think there's also something else to be said.
Hair. Admittedly, very different contexts.
Oh god, I'm trying to keep musical theater outside the scope of adaptation because there's like a whole set of books about fucking musical theater specifically because so many everything can be adapted to a musical and everything has been adapted to a musical. The Bible has like 20 different musicals about it, all of which are pretty mediocre and running in an independent playhouse near
you. I can't really be suggesting the Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yeah.
Okay. In addition to the fact that it was amazing, it also kickstarted a career that gave us the best Disney song. So,
okay, sure.
You know what's pamphlicestuous? I'll make a man out of you with the Bible.
Well, we have also agreed that much like Anne Rice, Jesus Christ Superstar is just super anti-Semitic, right? With it literally does take the bold perspective, what if Jews were the real Nazis? And you're like, oh, more of that.
Whoa.
This is not fucking against interpretation.
Actually, no, Sean just fucking opened up a valve in my brain that I had sealed for like safety purposes. There's like SCP warning lights there, but Sean was like, I wonder what that valve does. Oh shit, the Australian adaptation of Jesus Christ Superstar. And I come fucking emerging going, they're nuts. Okay. This is so important about adaptation. God damn it, Sean.
please stop putting I can't remember what the council is in.
The Pharisees?
The Pharisees, yeah. They're literally dressed in SS uniforms.
Okay. No. Sean is getting a little wrong because this is so much worse than you think it is. Buckle up, boys. We're going to Australia and we're coming back changed. Okay, so the original Jesus Christ Superstar was a pretty decent stage play, musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. Andrew Lloyd Webber once again insisting that he never wants to have to do anything to pay rent again. it was seen as this cool idea to merge like 60s rock and an agnostic perspective with the story of Jesus in a non-confrontational way. And then they were like, holy shit, somebody just cut us a check for $60,000 to turn it into a movie. Let's not spend that on boom mics. Let's spend it all on a trip to Israel. For tanks, we'll just whatever shit goes on there, we'll just roll cameras and hope they don't shoot at us. And when I say no boom mics, like you can hear the wind when they're singing.
Right? Oh, no.
But it's and then like the Romans are cast as kind of like beefy New York sex dungeon UN guys. And everything is great and it's wonderful. And a black man is Judas. Now, believe it or not, this is not as off. This is not as Anne Rice-y as it sounds.
Anne Rice-ist, Judas is, yeah.
Anne Rice-ist, yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Judas is cast as the hero of that movie. Now, we're so close to Easter that several Catholics are gnawing and gnashing their teeth right now.
Including Anne Rice's corpse.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But Judas is cast as the good guy in that. And that, like, the reason he sells out Jesus is because he's basically trying to get him into protective custody before he says something that's going to get him killed. And then it turns out that got him killed, so he killed himself. Mm-hmm. And then it just fucking takes off all over the world. Thing can't stop printing money. So enter, like, this medium-sized Australian-New Zealand co-production that decides that they're going to make a Jesus Christ Superstar adaptation and maybe convert some dollars into some dollary dues.
Okay.
It's a much higher quality production because it's not all just a camcorder in Israel. Now
they have the boom mics, actually.
Yeah, they have the boom mics. It's a stage. They can control the lighting. Jesus Before Pilate is the most questionable song. The Pharisees in this are they're dressed like the fucking, like, they're massive Matrix enthusiasts.
As you do.
And then they bring Jesus, who is wearing a diaper, as he also does, before Pilate, who is like this really tall, sexy, mixed race dude in an SS uniform. And then you look around and all the Romans are in SS uniforms. And you're like, I can kind of see it. And the point of this song is that the Pharisees and it's supposed to aggressively be the Pharisees are attempting to, like, hint at a revolt if you don't kill this Jesus guy. But Pilate is like, he didn't do anything wrong. I don't want to kill him. Jesus, just say you did nothing wrong. Ah, shit, he's talking about, like, kingdom come again. Fuck. When he's starting to doubt, the big part comes in where the Pharisees' supporters is supposed to... The music is supposed to be like a choir kicks in because it's supposed to indicate like the resonance of the urgency of the situation and musically how they're achieving such like a dominant position over the fastly fading Pilate. But instead they're like, no, we should see all the characters that are singing in this choir. And because they're the support of the Pharisees, they should be Jews. If they're Jews, they should be dressed like Jews. So a bunch of dudes in fucking round hats and like the fucking payoff curls and like the fucking traditional clothes are like climbing walls like spiders, yelling to kill Jesus, and like fucking screaming at Pilate that he's going to lose his career. We need Jesus's blood. And I'm like, oh my fucking Whoa. God, what did I just stumble into? Sean, what is this? Hold me, I'm scared.
Yeah.
I'm like, Stormfront Productions.
I feel like when a core thesis of adaptation theory is that any adaptation will get more anti-Semitic. So you just need to like make sure that there's like a big dial and you need to like physically hold it like a steering wheel of a wooden ship. Right?
Michael Crichton called it. It's like you can only adapt one thing so many times before transcription errors occur and you lose the source of the original. And the transcription errors are just anti-Semitism.
Yes. But that leads me to talk about three-body problem. Because we've talked about how the way adaptation works, all these things mean fidelity to the original work isn't the most important. Because what is fidelity to the original work? In no other premise do we talk about fidelity as like a quality in the work, right? We've talked about sentence level craft. We've talked about narrative structuring. We've talked about like themes and planning and making sure to outline. But none of it has been like, but make sure that it's really close to this other thing that exists somewhere else in the world.
Right. The last prelude to this, the last prelude that I'll add to this before we dive into this, because that is really important to understand and emphasize, is that like MJ is and you're talking about three different types of interview with the vampire, and like none of them resemble each other except that there's homosexual vampires.
Yes, that's the one underline.
You can't get rid of it. You can't.
Yeah. Down to the fact that Anne Rice was all like, guys, I'm telling you, that is not Lestat, actually.
Okay, and to be clear, they're homosexual vampires because they want to sleep with other vampires. Wanting to sleep with any human, regardless of sex, is heterosexual for vampires. We just had to put that on the table, right?
Mm-hmm. It's also kind of queer in vampire society.
Yeah, some vampires are queering vampire spaces by being like, no, I don't want to like just find a...
There's a lesser known one that's like very similar to this, where it's like, no, you're adapting it, but you're changing it to fit something else. But like even the creator went, this adaptation rules, because like your idea for the screen of Lestat kicked the shit out of my text idea of Lestat for the screen. A lesser known example is you've all seen Sideshow Bob step on 1,000 rakes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The that, as Sean pointed out, is an adaptation of the film Cape Fear. Not just a parody, but an adaptation. But Cape Fear is a remake.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Martin Scorsese remake of a 60s movie starring Robert
Someone
Mitchum.
Someone who isn't Robert De Niro.
Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck.
Mm-hmm. And that's a real-ass cast.
Yeah, and in this, everything is reversed. Everything is reversed. Mm-hmm. It's literally just straight up Robert Mitchum gets out of prison. He's like, I'm going to kill the shit out of my lawyer for not giving me or for not getting me off that murder that I did. Right. And Gregory Peck is all like, but I'm America's dad. I couldn't get the guy in fucking To Kill a Mockingbird off either. Did you even read that book that you cite on Twitter all the time? and that's all it is the perils. Now, it appeals like 1950s, 1960s people who can afford tickets, which is that, like, what if somebody outside the system is mad that they were outside the system and me in the system didn't save them from the system? I did the right thing. What am I going to do when this bad person comes for me? Whereas, like, the Scorsese adaptation just completely reverses that. Nick Nolte is all like, I'm getting a crisis of conscience for the first time in my life, and it's over a rape victim. I usually don't care for those women too much. I'm sorry that Nick Nolte is turning into Richard Nixon, but the overlaps are there.
I can see it.
And it's all about somebody in the system who like could have saved Robert De Niro from the system by playing the system, but he actually went outside the system to fuck Robert De Niro because Robert De Niro deserved to be fucked over by the system.
Mm-hmm. Because he's a monster. He's like the Antichrist.
Yeah, and the consequences that brings on him. But that bears no similarity except for the pamplisexual parts where, like, Robert Mitchum comes in and is all like, I'm a sheriff now, and if you don't mind looking the other way, I can take care of this with some lead pipes.
But yeah, no, I think that's actually a good comparison because obviously the De Niro Cape Fear is massively influential and important, right? And I would say the Mitchum Cape Fear is significantly less so, right?
Like its importance is that it was a launch pad for Scorsese, De Niro, and Nick Nolte.
Mm-hmm. And there's moments of adaptation where the different parts are important in different ways. Of course, we can talk about like Forbidden Fortress and fucking Star Wars A New Hope, right? Where you're like, okay, these are both big, important movies. We love them both. Go watch them both, right? This is a different example because like Game of Thrones, the same directors put together the Three Body Problem adaptation, and it's bad. And it's bad in ways that the book is not bad. And the book itself has problems. It's sprawling. It's confusing. It doesn't hold to a coherent singular narrative. It introduces characters very quickly and then takes them out of the plot very quickly, which again, I thought that would be okay for the Game of Thrones guys because they did that shit all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, they try and like do this weird maneuver where they like try and create this strange ensemble cast that does everything that needs to happen in Three Body Problem, and they simply don't. And so the story ends up really, really disjointed. Because the biggest thing is, Three Body Problem has about as much faith in the reader as any work can possibly have, right? Yeah. It's like, you remember that shit? Okay, good, because I'm not going to remind you.
I also have to point out how much of it makes me think that the author is just a Chinese version of Everard Clare. Because they're like, don't you think you should have like some exposition character development? Don't be stupid, Harry. What audiences love is science and physics. It's what hold us together. After all, it'll hold the story together.
But that's kind of true, right? Because it's about the three-body problem, as its title would indicate, is about the nature of problem, whether something is a scientific problem or a social problem or some kind of other out of context
or problem. A motivational problem with my second favorite character of the book. Like, for those of you that haven't read it, there's an entire aside where a guy is trying to explain how he got like these supercomputers connected to the society. He's like, I have to preface this with, I am really fucking lazy. Okay.
Yeah.
I need you to understand. What's the laziest you've ever been? Once I didn't microwave my burrito before I ate it. Dude, I'm way past that. Get on my fucking level. Yeah. Okay. I was vacillating, hoping somebody would call the police on my girlfriend before she started stinking and she died. Okay.
It literally happened. And like the nature of problems is what's at stake. Right. And this is clearly a very understandable narrative because there's a lot of other shows that are dumb shows that get this. So, for instance, the film Armageddon is about the nature of technical problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We've got a technical problem that's unsolvable. We need to solve the social problem first. Oh no, the social problem has become the technical problem. Oh no, the technical problem has become a social problem. How can I get through one night without you? Right? Like that's
I think, and in his very, very fucking typical way, the Steven Tyler walks in and goes, we can all solve the problem by having sex with my daughter.
Yes.
It was weird because when I was growing up, I was like, how do you think Steven Tyler felt about like singing the soundtrack to his daughter getting railed? And then I learned more about Steven Tyler and went,
Oh, no, that scans. Yeah.
No, he lobbied for the job.
This is we're taking a bold anti-Aerosmith stance here. Like, just Google Steven, for like okay, 1 minute.
I'm just going to say straight up, like, okay, Steven Tyler produces some great music and he's a fucking piece of fucking shit.
Yeah, the worst.
In his sex abuse trial of an underage person, his defense was, I was her legal guardian. I get to do that.
Oh, yeah. My God. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Sean, and it's crazy that he can still, like, walk in America compared to, like the directors who are like, no, it's fine that I was their legal guardian at the time, right? Like, I guess it's just fucking loving an elevator just turns people's brains off, right?
Yeah, apparently.
I believe he lost and then settled out, and it's fine. Which is not fine, but just the facts of the matter. But
it's weird because what he took away from it was no doubt, wow, being a legal guardian is expensive.
Yeah, this shit sucks. My God, I'll not do that next time. Literally, I believe that was his mindset because that wasn't the only time. Yeah, but
So lots of solving problems in Three Body Problem. Now, one of your, it's weird because my cat and I aren't watching it just yet because we have to cool off from our rage. Because they took a really bold step where they took the main character and said, you don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. They also dramatically, they de-main character, not just Wang Miao, the namesake of Chad's cat, but also Dashi. Dashi, whose name is now Clarence. Dashi is a nickname. I'm not kidding. They changed his name.
No, I love the idea that, like, I'm looking at the people. Wang Miao, as the protagonist, was broken up into, like, six different characters. Now, mm-hmm. not all of them are white. It's mm-hmm. actually kind of a diverse group of people.
It's literally so the Captain Planet ringdom.
So I'm looking at it, and I'm like, well, maybe it's not strictly whitewashing. Dashi's name is Clarence. Okay.
Okay. Well, he's still, he is still a Chinese man. That's the one thing. But the what I find more offensive about it is that they made him not fundamentally Chinese. They removed him from the Chinese government infrastructure. They removed the whole plot from China. So it's no longer about how China relates to the problem of its own history, which is a big fucking thing in the thing, right? Like, literally, it's about, like, okay, how we still have a communist centralized government. How are we different? How are we not fucking up anymore? And the answer is, we're not different.
Well,
we're
it
not
should still also be pointed out that, like, part of the problem is caused by the madness of early Chinese communist ideology. Like, I'm not even joking. There's a reason that the entire first third of that book is. If you had, okay, show of hands, does anybody here like The Great Leap Forward? Okay, please exit left. When you hear the screams of the abattoir, keep going through that hallway.
Yeah. Well, they keep all that shit, though. They keep the excesses of the Cultural Revolution, but they don't relate it at all to, like, actual real life China.
So that's what I was getting at, is that, like, the entire problem of the aliens coming comes from, like, it's a uniquely Chinese phenomenon.
Yes.
down to the fact that China itself could have stopped, or not necessarily stopped them. That my favorite part of that book is that the lady that basically summons the aliens going, fuck it, they'll take out Red China too. So fuck them.
UNG, fucking girl boss. Yeah. Incredible girl boss.
She gets caught by a commissar doing that. Mm-hmm. And the commissar goes, did you think I don't keep a log of everything that goes in here? I'm a commissar.
It's my literal job.
Yeah. And she goes, so what are you going to do? He goes, nothing. I burned all the logs. She goes, why would you do that? And he goes, because there are only two outcomes. The first is that they're enlightened aliens, in which case they will embrace space Bolshevism and we will form a mutual transgalactic harmonious party. Or two, they're not, and thus aren't as enlightened as us, and they will break themselves against the Red Guard. Therefore, this isn't worth the premier's time, so I burned it.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, fuck, Jesus, this is a moment of fucking ideological problemization, right? Like, he's solving a problem with this ideology, and it's not working. The show does not care about problems. Anytime there's a problem, it just skips past it. It's like, how are we going to solve this thing? She wrote a problem on the whiteboard, and it's done, right? Like, they literally don't even talk about, like, I need to solve the three-body problem. They just say, isn't the three-body problem unsolvable? And then she solves it. Literally cut. Different scene. Problem solved.
You know,
she doesn't have to go to the incredibly lazy man.
That book had me read a lot of science journals. And I think some of the, like, serious no shit certain scientists would like to meet this lady who is just like,
I turned out
you didn't carry the one.
I made a whiteboard and it worked. That's fine. And you're like, no, this is the whole thing, is that it doesn't care about the transformation of the problem. It doesn't care about these things. And I think by decentralizing it, it's literally like if you took a season of Roots and you took, like, the first three episodes and then you just cut to, like Midnight in Paris. And you're like, you're connected. And you're like, yeah, but what happened with the black people and the slavery and the peculiar institution? It's like, well, I don't care about that anymore. Look how good, like, the present day in Europe is. And you're like,
well, look at these good really shots. So all of the stuff about, like, the three-body problem, about yelling dehydrate a lot, about being involved in an MMOverse, what this, like, actually does is deftly navigate the notion of how conflict occurs in a socio-political way, period. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, the Trisolarians just couldn't figure out how to survive the three-body problem, so mm-hmm. said, fuck it, we're steamrolling Earth then.
Yeah.
Why? They don't have a three-body problem that we can't solve.
Exactly. That it's about them solving that problem. But the way it's translated is that the game in the book is a piece of propaganda. That you play it, you figure out their
like most MMOs.
Yes. it presents this issue, the planet is being destroyed. How do you stop the planet from being destroyed? Well, we can figure it out. If we figure out when the planet won't be destroyed, we can build civilization, then it'll be fine. And then over time, you iterate and iterate, and you keep finding out that, no, even with this solution, civilization still won't last forever because this will eventually fuck up. The only way to save it is by leaving. And that's how you are convinced to let them to Earth. Whereas in the fucking show, it literally is like, level one, you figured out that science is important. I'm not even kidding. Level two, you figured out it's a three-star SAR system. Level three, you figured out that the problem was keeping the Trisolarans alive, not space or whatever. And I'm like, are you kidding me? It doesn't work as a propaganda tool if you translate this. If you don't focus on the problems, you don't give the audience the capacity to solve it.
They're trying to incept two very important things into people. The first piece of inception is that it's totally awesome when Isaac Newton just fucking stabs the shit out of somebody with a rapier.
Yeah, that's cool.
The
Hobo Albert Einstein is also cool.
The second thing it's desperately trying to incept, and not convince you, incept, right? Like, Leo is down there doing fucking parkour in your brain.
Yeah, dodging a train, the whole deal.
Yeah. Is that, I should arrive at the conclusion that, that yes, we should be Untermensch for the Trisolarans. It's only fair and nice. And, like, strangely, when I also put it that way, it's, like, because it was all designed by the biggest problem in the book, which is that there's a transhuman communist and he's not currently Swiss cheese. How do we solve this problem? Right. A line that was mentioned on page 7.
Yes. Remember that thing that he was researching? They also have like a test of the nanotubes just cutting a diamond randomly in the start of it, where they're like, cut a big diamond. And you're like, okay, what the fuck? Why would you do that? But the big thing I want to take away from this is that the new three-body problem isn't not good because it fails to be three-body problem, but because it doesn't have its own thing going on. That without problematization, without like a continuous history of China, without like any kind of narrative structure that like reflects an intention for each episode, an arc that's finishable, other than the general anxiety about there's an alien invasion, you don't have much of a show, because there's an alien invasion is already the plot in like 50% of all sci-fi shows.
Mm-hmm.
And
I bet there's not even a really cool moment where like they accidentally thread all over everything and it scares everybody with ghost thread.
I don't know. I haven't gotten to the Sofon making part. Big spoilers.
So I would ask then, would you say that part of the issue is not that it's a divergent work, but instead that it's a work that exists purely as aesthetic exploitation of a base work?
Yes, that it's using the name and the gravitas of the three-body problem to create a work by the creators of Game of Thrones, hiring as many Game of Thrones actors as possible on a prestige platform with a big release, a lot of signs on the sides of buses, without much intention beyond that sequence of words I just said.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether it was going to be a Warhammer or a three-body problem or a Star War or a Zack Snyder's fake Star War thing. It's all the same, just consume product. And the differentiatedness of three-body problem, which is so fucking differentiated. That's the best thing about it, is how different it is from anything else you can like pick up on a shelf today, is very much lost.
Yeah, now including the fact that, like, and it's not new, you can go pick up an H.G. Wells book from the Penguin Classics section and get that.
Yeah, you're like, oh shit, aliens are invading. That's fucking crazy. Why are these aliens speaking German? It's like, because that's the only thing we're goddamn scared about in England.
Is real fast, before I push through my two key examples, out of curiosity, since we invoked War of the Worlds, Steven Spielberg said, what if War of the Worlds was 9/11? Is it a successful adaptation? Now, we're not talking about like financial success or critical success. We're comparing this to like three-body problems adaptation.
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of forgettable. That's the thing, is that so much of its granularity is lost.
I want to note that Sean just said 9/11 was forgettable. Continue.
No, I mean the movie itself is forgettable because
never forget personally.
Okay, because so much of it, like, you can cut in random scenes from the fucking Batman v Superman, like Batman parts where he has 9/11 anxieties. Right?
Okay, wait, so is Batman versus Superman the control group for adaptation theory?
I mean, I don't see why not, right?
Do we slice in sections of Batman v Superman, and if it continues to line up, it's not a successful adaptation?
Yeah, you introduce a basic monoculture to it, and it works fine.
Yeah, no, it fucking scans with Clash of the Titans.
Mm-hmm. But that's the premise, right? If there's not much differentiating it from the scenes affair of the quote unquote post 9/11 disaster movie as a genre, then I think that you failed as an adaptation, because it could be anything. It could be War of the Worlds. It could be fucking Island of Dr. Moreau, right? It's nothing.
I love the fact that, like, you're also kind of low-key hinting that you could have just sliced in that Robert Pattinson was on top of a building and was killed by aliens, and it would still continue.
Yes, Dear John could have just been alien.
I'm so glad I linked that video to you. That video.
I didn't
so
watch good. That video. I just know that shit offhand.
No, I know you know that, but that's why I linked it to you. Because now in our lexicon is somebody saw the double whammy of autism and 9/11 and thought they had Oscar Gold.
Oh, yeah. Fucking incredibly loud and very close.
So adaptation from, in my quick wrap up, adaptation from book to film is actually like unreal challenging. And part of the reason we think that it isn't that challenging is partially because we're assholes, right? Because we sit there and we look at the $100+ million product and go, I could have done better.
Nah, I could have done
better. Yeah. It's like all the people are like, you know, if Hitler had just invaded the Soviet Union a month earlier, he would have captured Moscow. It's obvious. It's easy. I don't know why. You know, dude, shut up. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very, very hard. But the other reason is that, like, we also see, like, the really successful ones, and we remember those, and then we forget, like, the really dog shit ones. And for some weird reason, we also tend to forget how hard it is to make a good movie. And for this reason, it's really useful to go back and look at a movie that is really, 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 really bad. And I don't just mean, like, there's Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter, which is a wonderfully bad movie. If you haven't seen it, Sean, I recommend that you see it.
I have seen that one.
Okay, wonderful. I feel that Jesus and a Libre Mexican wrestler are the natural duo to save lesbians. also, it gave me the new line, if I'm not back in 5 minutes, call the Pope. The film that Danny Glover hasn't watched, invoking this buildup, laying this foundation like fucking Three Body Problem itself, is a film that you will have a hard time finding called Out.
I think it's called Deadly Drifter, actually.
It is also known as Deadly Drifter, because it turns out calling something out is a fucking nightmare to describe. So they also were like, they took some photos of Peter Coyote and Danny Glover from different movies and slapped it onto an American flag and rebranded it as Deadly Drifter and hoped that drove up sales. But the problem is, this is the worst film ever made. And I don't just mean like, wow, this was like badly executed. They didn't know what they were doing when they made this film. And it itself is an adaptation of a really shitty book called Out. Turns out the author of the book was one of the screenwriters.
Oh, dear.
And so I picked out the book on Digital Archive and thumbed through it. And I'm like, oh, this is just unreadable garbage. This is the 70s when any man with a typewriter and a postage stamp could have gotten published. So what is the movie about? I don't know. I can't tell you. But when I say, like, it's a bad movie, I mean, like, visibly. So they also don't have they only have boom mics. They only discover ADR halfway through the film. And it's when they brought in a Native American guy that sounds suspiciously like Norm Macdonald, who's there to deliver like all six racist things the director thinks he knows about Native Americans.
It's true. It's fucking like uncomfortable. Every fucking thing he says is like, okay. And then it's like, sings indigenously ? And you're like, no, stop.
Yeah. And then he's like, now you must know the stone as you would know a woman. And then we will smoke peyote. There's no build-up to this. He just shows up, does this, and then the scene ends, and then he's walking through. The title card says Nevada. The geology says Agua Dulce. Okay? Mm-hmm. And the reason I keep bringing up Danny Glover is because he's in this movie, kind of. Like, he's just there sometimes, except this one really weird part where he's all like, you found me. We need some money. And Peter Coyote's like, okay. And he walks into a gas station and starts cranking a slot machine. His coins keep coming out. And Danny Glover keeps going, do it again. Hey, where are you going? And then, like, that's it until they have hot dogs on a beach. And, like, this isn't – okay, this is funny to describe, but this isn't funny. This wasn't done in the form of a comedy. The director didn't know what he was doing. He's the script is mind blowing. There's a part where like Peter Coyote, who may or may not be a commando of some sort, I don't fucking know. comes in and is all like, "Yeah, I'm a cop. I'm gonna fuck your girlfriend. She's pretty cute." And he's all like, "She's not my girlfriend." "Oh yeah, when's your girlfriend gonna get here?" Soon. Okay, well, I'm gonna fuck her then. Okay, geez, man. And then he takes her back to the hotel room to fuck her, and then they agree to get married, and then, like, there's a Julia Child's cooking recipe segment.
Well, okay. That's after he tries to commit suicide with a stick of dynamite.
Yeah, and then she cooks him dinner with his Julia Child recipe, and he wants slom for some reason, whatever the fuck that is. He has a meltdown because he can't have slom, and then she is all like, "You're just trying to use me like those guys. I'm out of here." And then sleeps in the closet. And he's like, "Why are you sleeping there?" "Because I always sleep in here." But meanwhile, the real reason is because, like, it would raise legal problems if she walked out of the Motel 6 that they're not actually renting from while naked. And it just continues on and on and on throughout this movie with all these problems where the actors visibly run out of dialogue and are, like, looking over at the camera going, "Are you going to yield cut? We're still rolling. Just say things."
You want a hot dog?
Yeah, I got hot dogs. Do you know what's in a hot dog? Independence Day. How is that in the hot dog? It's a firework. Look, the firework has symbolism. We're on a beach. Did you know that next to Venice Beach is Santa Monica Pier? I know they're not really that close, but
they're kind of close if you drive. Yeah.
They both touch the Santa Monica, or they both touch the Pacific Ocean. Sorry, I know people in Santa Monica think it's the Santa Monica Ocean, but and these are like principal failings of somebody that doesn't understand how complex and complicated shooting a film is, much less going in and editing it into something that somebody can watch, right? Now compare this to, unfortunately, this is the only time this will ever be happening. Compare this to Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. Right, which hilariously gets into hot water a lot from certain breeds of Tolkien fans. They're like, "Well, that wasn't in the Tolkien book." Unfilmable, that part of the Tolkien book. Okay, no, I think Tom Bombadil would have been very filmable. It would have been a scene from Out. Okay, and so like when you start to understand these pieces of how hard it is in order to like convey a scene, because all. I'm not implying that Tolkien had it easy, but in order to achieve something, all Tolkien had to do was say, "He blew the horn and a great sound of fury arose," right? And like, now you're done. You're in the zone. You're ready. In filming, like, there are so many ways that cannot, you want a horn to blow and it to raise the sound of fury, but you have to worry about how that's intersecting with existing dialogue, how that fits in the current frame, if that person is framed or not, if they are off camera doing it, whether that registers as a distraction or if that registers as an assent to what's currently going on screen, how long you should be on screen with the character you're currently focused on before the audience's eyes start to glaze over. Statistically, when they're going to fish for popcorn, when you start to deliver this line of dialogue, when the soundtrack should kick in, all of these in order to frame relatively simple ideas, meaning that during this jump from page to film, a lot of things have to be altered and changed. And to me, one of the big questions is if something is a good adaptation. So I have a preference for adaptation. I like things that take something from one medium and successfully transfer what you got from that medium to another medium. Now, in that way, Lord of the Rings doesn't succeed 100% because Peter Jackson veers way off the "God, I wish we lived in peace" into "Goddamn, killing orcs is fun."
Yeah, it's so fucking cool.
Yeah, but it's as successful as Lord of the Rings has managed, especially in a way that has to put asses in seats, which also includes people that don't give a shit about the politics of pastoral fucking islands against industrialization. To me, the way this hits like the best is that when Aragorn arrives in Rohan in the Two Towers, he stops and recites this poem about where is the horse and the rider, where is the horn that was blowing ere the sun rises. And what it's supposed to get across is that he's expositing to legalists and thus to us, because legalists like a black person in Anne Rice book isn't really people, but he's kind of like people.
Jesus Christ.
Legolas is dumbfounded by knowing both now the history of the Rohirrim and knowing where he is and getting a sense of what their poetry is like and what that poem means and who it came from and whatnot. And it makes sense in like the tone of their arrival. Now, the Aragorn could not have stopped running before Viggo Mortensen actually broke his toe, in case you didn't know that, to go, hey guys, you want to hear some sick slam poetry about horse people?
Here's a fucking poem, brother.
Yeah, there's no way to do that. However, they both got across visually, aesthetically, and narratively what the Rohirrim are all about, and they weaseled the fucking poem in through Théoden. Right? It's fucking mind-blowing how successfully he was able to take these things and go, screen is not same. Well, but they both use words. They sure do, buddy. Get back to your bucket.
Mm-hmm. And I think that fucking rounds us out, right? Lord of the Rings, yeah. Actually really unfaithful, out/Deadly Drifter, possibly most faithful. One of them is watchable, one of them isn't.
Yes. Yes. And it helps to understand, to really drive home, look at those components and get and understand why adaptation is change the parameters of what a successful adaptation is by understanding the components that go into crafting something in a certain way. Especially because any teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that don't involve the Brady Bunch from hell is the secrets of the ooze can stay occluded.
It's a false idol. That we must destroy.
Yes.
All right. I think that has been an episode. In the description for this episode, there will be a link to all of our socials, including our Discord, where you can talk to us directly about your favorite adaptations and talk to us about Anne Rice shit and like what the fuck is going on with the Witching Hour series, because they cut out so much cool shit from the book. It's no longer SCP Foundation. They de-SCP Foundation. But of course, it would be of great help to us if you could leave a like, maybe leave a positive review on this episode, maybe share it with a friend who's interested in, I'm not sure about what it means to adapt a thing, because verisimilitude seems a lot more important than, you know, adherence to the script. But if you want to support us more directly, there will be a link to our Ko-fi where you could help fund Meow's healthcare, because this kitty was very sick and she's gonna need your help as this comes up. We're not joking about this. This is not like a this is not no, like a prank.
We can lighten it just a little. If you don't like Benioff and Weiss, consider that I wrote them a letter signed by my vet that said that the only cure for her condition is if Wong Miao is in Three Body Problem, and they went, well.
But yes,
no, she's fine, but she's going to she's got a road ahead of her.
She's got require kitty medication for the long term, right?
Yes.
And it would help us out a lot if you could contribute to some of that. We will reward you with more cat pictures.
Yes. She has a favorite towel now, and she's really cute when she lays on it.
Aww. Does she still have the pizza box or no?
No, I had to throw that shit out. We will be going to Roma's Pizza soon, and she'll have a new pizza box.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
But like a kitty in a pizza box, dear listener, we hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.